Okay, so today I'm here with Graham Smith, and we are talking about Canada's role in Afghanistan. So Graham has written this great book, "The Dogs Are Eating Them Now: Our War in Afghanistan," and it's I would almost consider it if you took Thomas Ricks's fiasco, and you made it more of a memoir, and then you made it about Canada. This would be it because it is. It's definitely intense. It has the sort of intensity and sort of personalization of a memoir. But Graham does definitely bring in sort of the larger concepts and sort of, looking at the war, this supposedly good war that, you've got the consent of the international community. It's a right of defense. It's a war that was begun as a right of defense. And it's the book is really heartbreaking because most people associate counterinsurgency problems with the United States, but it's not just the United States that sort of is, I won't say bad at it, but sort of has difficulty, engaging in counterinsurgency. It's an issue that's been with NATO, with Canada, and, it's very much a sort of, larger international issue. So today we're going to start off with looking at Canada's role in Afghanistan, from 2006 to about 2011, when Canada they transitioned to more of a training from combat to training, and then from halfway point on, we're going to talk about sort of the larger issues, Pakistan's role in Afghanistan, and whether, is this. How do we understand Afghanistan as a whole? Because as everybody knows that 2014 is coming and sort of NATO, the United States, whomever is sort of washing their hands clean of this conflict. So I want to start off with, you start the book in 2006. So I'm sort of curious, I mean, what was the sort of the reasoning for this? I mean, why not, start it with 2010 or 2002.
Oh, thanks. It's a really generous introduction, and I'm happy to be able to unspool some of this stuff in a format like this, because I think this sort of a podcast that that runs at length is a really cool idea. I would say though that I really take pains in the book not to be writing from a Canadian perspective or only about Canadians. In the very introduction of the book, I write this passage about who is we, who is us, because this is a project that involved us in the broadest sense. It wasn't just the Americans, although the Americans provided the lion's share of the money and the manpower and the soldiers. It really did. It brought in dozens of NATO countries, non-NATO ISAF members, non-NATO, non-ISAF donors that backed up the mission in various ways. And even among the journalists who were there at the time, it was very easy to fall into this sort of collective sense of we, that even though we might have used the third person in our copy that, over beers or gin's tonic, sitting around Kabul, we were probably talking about us. What were we doing, in the South? And it definitely started to take on the fight itself started to take on a more international character around about 2005, 2006, which is when I start the narrative. It's also when I arrived. I first arrived in 2005, and that's the first chapter. I describe driving from Kabul down to Kandahar in September 2005, and at that time it was still possible to make that drive. After that, you had to take a bus because it was getting increasingly dangerous, and then after that, in 2007, it became completely no-go. And today, just today, I was giving advice to a journalist saying, please, please, please do not drive the road from Kabul to Kandahar, because I said to him, it's not a risk, it is a certainty that you will hit a Taliban checkpoint on that road. So it's the narrative is this arc of me arriving as a a wide-eyed 26-year-old correspondent in 2005 and being incredibly impressed, you know, incredibly impressed by the giant machinery of war, by the, you know, by the armies with all of their sophisticated technologies, impressed by all these, you know, noble, you know, UN people and NGO people and everybody who was involved in this giant project. And then, you know, I increasingly get disappointed and disillusioned, and the book becomes a fairly kind of bitter rant, I guess, about how we failed. You know, the central mission was to bring peace and stability, and there were all kinds of other things that we tried to bring at the same time. You know, rule of law and democracy and women's rights and all those good things, but. But peace and stability were the core elements of the mission, and just measurably those things have not been achieved. You know, this year violence is up considerably. We're back to peak levels of violence in Afghanistan, and so peace has not been achieved. Has stability been achieved? Well, you know, humanitarian access is now far more limited than it was when NATO started surging in there in 2005-06. So. You know, again, measurably, you know, stability, you know, was not achieved. You can argue about democracy. You can argue about all kinds of other things. But the point is that we failed in what we were trying to do.
So, I mean, let's sort of get into the sort of details of it. You know, how would you describe the war? I mean, you know, I almost felt like you could have divided up your book, at least, you know, arbitrarily. I mean, you know, from the period of 2006 when you arrive to about, you know, 2008, 2009, 2010, you know, sort of the circle of that period when you sort of had the Obama administration, you know, come to power in the U.S. and sort of, you know, and I think a large part of his administration was, you know, we're going to focus on the good war. We're going to, you know, get involved more in Afghanistan. But, you know, before we get to that, you know, sort of describe the war for us from 2006 to 2010. You know, I'll limit this question so we don't end up going everywhere. But you know, on the sort of the four points of that you brought up: political stability, training of the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Police, or you know, even the police, you know, local police, and then you know, the issues of violence, and then democracy and corruption. I mean, did you see progress from 2006 to, you know, 2009, 2010, or was this really, you know, just as futile 6 years ago as it, you know, was a year ago from, you know, our time right now?
You know, here's the problem. When you're talking about a complicated task like this, progress is such a stupid way to describe what you're doing. And we really need to get away from this idea of like, we're making progress, we're not making progress. Because, you know, if a doctor is working on a patient and manages to get, you know, the blood pressure to the right levels, but the guy stops breathing, you know, you've made progress on the blood pressure, but the guy stopped breathing, the patient's dead. You know, there have been fantastic things that have happened now that the foreigners are here in Afghanistan, across a whole range of things. You know, polio is less common than it ever was before. Women are less likely to die while giving birth to a child. Millions of girls are in school who wouldn't have been in school before. It's very hard to get statistics, but it looks as though life expectancy is going up. You know, prosperity in terms of just the sheer amount of money sloshing around this place. You know, there has been a lot of prosperity for the last decade or so. Look, you know, good things have happened in Afghanistan. But the fact of the matter is that if you build a clinic in some district and you improve the lives of the people in that district by building that clinic, that is a wonderful, wonderful thing. But if you can't tell me who's going to control that district next year, the year after that, then I'm sorry, but I'm not exactly sure what you have given to the people of Afghanistan in this case. It's That we're at this moment now of withdrawal where nobody knows what will happen next. I mean, I spend my time now as an analyst for the International Crisis Group. I live in Afghanistan and I travel around various Western capitals. And the range of scenarios that you hear in terms of what's going to happen next in Afghanistan is breathtaking. And just the simple reality is that it's a giant pullout that's underway without any clear idea about what that means for Afghanistan's future. So and that's a tragedy. You know, we simply should not be leaving Afghanistan with this much uncertainty. You were asking about the period, the initial series of surges into the south. I was there in Kandahar in 2005 before NATO took security responsibility for southern Afghanistan. I should clarify too, by the way, that the book is about southern Afghanistan. I'm just now in my new job as an NGO guy. I've started traveling around to different parts of Afghanistan, to the north, the east, the west, but. You know, my years in the south were fairly focused. I didn't really visit other parts. I went over into Pakistan a few times. And when NATO surged in there, Canada first sent 2,500 guys in the spring of 2006. That effectively doubled the number of troops in that whole southern region, number of pro-government troops. There were about 2,500 Americans before at that time. And the surges just continued. You know, the Americans sent in 6,000, and, you know, pretty soon it just became this kind of snowballing. You know, everybody was down there. All the you know, major powers sent someone. It became a bit of a special forces Olympics for a while. There were so many different uniforms amongst the special forces guys you'd see in the cafeteria at Kandahar Airfield. And, you know, by the very peak of it, by summer of 2011, you know, we were up around somewhere around 70,000 pro-government forces. It was, you know, it was a thundering, heavy presence. You know, just as those levels of troops increased, levels of violence across all kinds of categories increased almost in lockstep with the number of troops. So, you know, we hit a peak at the summer of 2011, and those of us, you know, I had written, you know, opinion pieces and gone on TV and stuff and around, you know, say like 2008, saying, look, please do not send the next surge, because we could see the surges coming. They were building Kandahar Airfield much, much bigger, getting ready to accept more troops. And I said, look, you know, this is going to result in more bloodshed. It's just, and you're not going to achieve your aims. It's very, very clear that, you know, dramatically increasing the number of troops in southern Afghanistan is going to result in dramatically more killing and not a whole lot of what you're trying to achieve. And unfortunately, that is what happened. And so I started to feel very smart, you know, but very sad. And then in 2012, last year, when the troops started to withdraw and the violence started to go down, of course, I started to feel very smart, right? Because it's like, okay, there's a direct correlation between number of troops and levels of violence. But as usual in Afghanistan, because this is an incredibly complicated and confounding place, I was wrong, completely wrong. If you look more closely at the violence levels in 2012, the declines in violence were heavily towards the beginning of the year on year, and that's largely as a result, apparently, of a cold winter in early 2012. You know, the Taliban wear flip flops; they don't like to go running around in the cold mud. And so the violence was back up basically to 2011 levels in the second half of 2012. And what that means is there's very little correlation with the troop declines, because the troop withdrawals were heavily in the second half of 2012. And then if there was any doubt about that lack of correlation, this year, 2013, is very very clearly demonstrating that, because we're seeing, you know, much, much fewer foreign troops, and the foreign troops that are here are doing many, many fewer operations outside the wire. And despite that, the violence is up considerably, roughly 50%. And so what you end up with is places like, I was recently up in Faryab province, and Faryab is an interesting case study because it has been without foreign troops for about 12 months. It used to have Norwegians, it used to have U.S. Special Forces, a few others. They are all gone. There are no foreign troops up there whatsoever now anymore. And what's happened is the Taliban have made a nice rhetorical pivot from fighting off the infidels to fighting off the munafiqeen, you know, the betrayers of Islam, the puppets, the, you know, all the bad words that they use for the Afghan administration. And the fight goes on, you know, bigger than ever. It's, the violence is up dramatically. And, you know, the Afghan security forces are having to do some fairly desperate things to hang on. When I was up there, the police were telling me that they had organized cavalry charges on horseback over hills, you know, firing automatic weapons from their saddles. If you can imagine that, how messy that is. You know, because they didn't have any NATO helicopters to back them up. So, nobody knows what will happen next, but some of what we're seeing this year points to a continued escalation.
So how would you, I mean, I think a big part of the NATO mission has been training Afghan security forces. So I took this as the ANA, the Afghan National Army, and the Afghan National Police, ANP. And in your book, you have this very sort of interesting anecdote about a guy with a motorcycle. He comes to a checkpoint and he doesn't want his motorcycle stolen, so he throws the keys in the bushes. And so he paddles the motorcycle up to the checkpoint, and the police say, you know, why don't you, I think it's, if I remember it clearly, why don't you have keys in your motorcycle? And he said, well, I threw them in the bushes. So the police beat him up and take his money or take something, but he keeps his motorcycle. So
yeah.
I think that hopefully I've told the story correctly.
Yeah, that's about correct.
I'm sort of curious. I mean, you know, how well are the police and, you know, even the National Army, how well are they trained, you know, in terms of being able to independently operate? And, you know, a sub point to that is, you know, are they there to protect the Afghan population and sort of administer justice, or are they, you know, almost beyond, you know, they're so corrupt, they're sort of own little mafia, little, you know, gang, so to speak?
Well, I mean, there is tremendous, tremendous variation within the Afghan security forces. You know, at the very top end, you have guys who've been trained by U.S. Special Forces, guys who have been on, you know, the top flight, you know, training in Britain and America. You know, these are people who you can trust with your life. They are incredibly professional and very, very capable. Unfortunately, there aren't enough of them. There aren't that many of them. And the bulk of the fighting this year, you know, a lot of the burden is falling on the Afghan local police, the ALP. And this is a fairly new unit. They were raised, you know, hastily. The estimate is there's somewhere around 20,000 of them now, although maybe a little bit more. The Americans are hoping to bump up that number to 45,000. It's going to cost a little bit more than $1 billion. And what this is essentially asking people from ordinary, you know, ordinary villagers, you know, hey, would you like a gun? Would you like a white pickup truck? Come on in here. We're going to give you, you know, 2 or 3 weeks of training. And then you're going to go back and protect your village and kill Taliban. And in practical terms, you know, in some places that has worked out relatively well because they've been managing to use that program to recruit Taliban foot soldiers, believe it or not. So you're seeing some insurgents just, you know, flip over and become police, which is, that's a win, you know. Now, you still have some concerns about how they're behaving, obviously. You know, you told that story about the, you know, the motorbike and et cetera. But in a lot of places, that's probably a minority of the places. In a lot of places, what that means is if you are trying to go into the villages and recruit people to kill Taliban, realistically, the people you're recruiting for, you know, for the most part are going to be Mujahideen. This is, you know, the people who were fighting the Soviets in the 1980s, you know, took over the country, and then were ousted by the Taliban between 94 and 96. And so because they've been actively fighting the Taliban since, you know, depending on the geography, 94 to 96, you know, they were probably fighting the Taliban anyways, and the ALP has just, you know, thrown gasoline on that fire. And it's a very mixed picture. You know, we there have been terrible complaints about abuses, you know, torture, extrajudicial killings, all kinds of stuff, misbehavior by the ALP. And at the same time, I've spoken to, you know, a couple of governors now out in, you know, provinces affected by the insurgency. And they tell me, look, Graham, you know, we know there are concerns about the ALP. You know, we know they're bad guys. But we need them to stay alive. You know, if we don't have these ALP, the Taliban are going to come over those walls and they're going to slit my throat, you know. And so it's... We've created this military situation where, in some ways, these irregular forces are necessary if you want to, you know, keep all these provincial capitals from falling. And so, I think the challenge is going to be, and I might end up writing a paper about this sometime next year. The challenge is going to be somehow bringing the ALP to heel, you know, bringing them in line, and trying to. Curb the abuses and somehow, you know, make these men part of society, because right now they are, you know, to some extent a law unto themselves out in the districts. You know, I met an ALP commander in Kunar a few weeks ago, and he said to me, "Oh yeah, my 17-year-old son got kidnapped." And I said, "Oh, you know, Commandant Seb, I'm very sorry to hear that." And he said, "Oh yeah, no." He says, "I'm on it. No problem. I'm taking care of it." I said, "How are you taking care of it?" He said, "Oh well, I've gone out to the village where those Taliban are, and I have arrested 45 villagers from that area." And you know, like the ALP, first of all, has no authority to arrest people. If they do detain people, they are supposed to hand them over immediately to the local authorities. This ALP commander said to me bluntly, "Look, I'm keeping these guys in my private, you know, homes, essentially dungeons, you know." And he was very bold, you know, about saying, "You got to get Kabul off my back. I have to be able to do what I need to do." So the sense of impunity amongst the ALP commanders, the sense of independence is a little bit worrying from the point of view of having an organized central state.
So, I mean, before we get to the problem of sort of centralization and sort of political power extending, you know, from the center all over the country, you know, I'm sort of curious about the tension over opium, because that was something that became sort of apparent to me in your book. I mean, it's always, you know, I've read sort of Gretchen Peters' work on the Seeds of Terror and sort of her, you know, her shorter journal articles about the opium heroin game in Afghanistan. But your book sort of almost made it sort of personal, where I think there was a scene in there where you had a commander sort of comes into this village and, you know, I think the village head tells him, you know, we need the opium to, you know, it's our crop. And, you know, commander's sort of goal is eradication or limitation or whatever. But, you know, how do we factor in the sort of growth of opium into sort of what you've already sort of explained to us?
Well, it looks as though the UNODC numbers this year are going to be pretty bleak. We're going to have a much bigger crop this year, I think. Here's the problem. We've gone in and tried to fix a lot of problems all at once in Afghanistan. And one of them was opium. And, you know, Afghanistan does eventually need a legitimate economy that is not, based on drugs. Hillary Clinton was probably not wrong when she described Afghanistan as a narco state. However, these things take time. And it's really scary and dangerous when the West comes into an area like southern Afghanistan with all of our big ideas and our strong values about, you know, fighting a war on drugs, and just starts slashing and burning the poppy fields. It seems like a good idea, right? Like, you want to discourage illegal activity, so you go and you hire a bunch of guys to start destroying opium fields. That, you know, on paper that makes total sense. In a boardroom in Washington, that makes total sense. The problem is that what happens is, okay, you've destroyed a field of opium. The farmer who was growing that opium borrowed money from drug dealers to fund his little farming operation. He's now got a debt that he can't pay off. So he's going to have to sell one of his daughters. You know, young girls get sold off for bride prices of about $5,000. And so she's going to, you know, his daughter's going to get married to some ugly old man, probably as a result of this, these so-called opium brides. You've now pissed off the farmer. And just like in America, it's a car in every driveway. You know, in Afghanistan, it's a Kalashnikov under every bed. You know, the farmer probably has an AK. He probably has an RPG. He is, you know, going to, you know, join the insurgency. You know, the insurgency will offer him cash maybe to help out, or maybe he'll just help out gratis because he's so pissed off. There was a strong correlation. We did a small survey of Taliban in 2007, early 2008, and what we found was an astonishing number of the Taliban we interviewed said that they or their families had personally experienced poppy eradication, that their own fields had been targeted. And that was amazing, because if you look at the map of Kandahar, the number of fields being eradicated was actually not that high. It was, you know, a program that was going on. It was symbolic, basically to please the foreigners. And so if that many Talibs said that their fields had been targeted, it meant that either the government was punitively going after people they knew were Talibs and eradicating them, which was problematic in and of itself, or that by going in and eradicating some, you know, fields, that these people then became Taliban. And either way, you know, there was this huge overlap, this connection between the war on drugs and the counterinsurgency, and it wasn't a good connection.
Well, I'm sort of curious, I think the rationale that we hear in the West, in the United States at least, is that the sale of opium funds the Taliban. And so by that logic, because it sort of funds the Taliban, then we must go after that growth. I mean, in your experience in Afghanistan, is that true? I mean, is it?
Yeah,
is the growth of opium? Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, it's definitely true. I met a man in Dalbandin, Pakistan, near the border, who said that he had personally seen the crisp bricks of money being handed by drug dealers to Taliban in Quetta. And he was impressed that they still had the bank seals on the bricks. It's definitely true that the drug money funds the Taliban. But is it the Taliban's biggest source of income? I would be skeptical of that. I think they have lots of other income streams. And lots of other people in Afghanistan profit from the poppy trades, not only the Taliban. I would guess that there are figures in the Afghan government. There are independent figures, independent drug dealers, who also take fairly large cuts. So the money, the poppy money, actually gets spread around pretty widely. And you can't just cut the funding off to the Taliban by burning the poppy fields. That just doesn't work.
So I want to sort of, you brought up the issue of corruption and sort of, on two levels, the ALP, being independent of the capital. I guess that could be considered a form of corruption. But, I'm sort of curious. I mean, when you were in Afghanistan, what was the dynamic between Kabul and Kandahar? I mean, was the capital sort of able to tie itself to the south, or, did the two sort of operate independently? Because it almost seems like, you have Kabul and you have all the political bodies, and political actors in Kabul making decisions, but it almost seems that decisions and political power in Afghanistan are very much local and very much, I want to say even regional and maybe even down to, the district. So I mean,
I mean,
oh,
what's
well.
interesting actually about the Karzai government, and this is something we might miss about President Karzai once he's gone, or not, I don't know, depending on your perspective, but is that there were these strong ties sometimes from the center to the periphery, in surprising ways. Right down to the point where Karzai would get on the phone and intervene in some local tribal dispute. When in 2007, when this huge Mujahideen commander named Mulla Naqib, when he was killed, or not killed, he was hit by a IED and then went away for medical treatment, and then he died a somewhat natural death that fall. When he died, it left this huge power vacuum. It was as I describe in the book. It just shifted the whole military landscape. It was because this Alakozai tribe had been protecting the northern side of Kandahar City from the Taliban, and with the death of this powerful warlord, things were sort of in chaos within his own tribe. And Karzai came in on a helicopter. This is the president of the country, going to sit with a bunch of tribesmen from one particular tribe in a southern province, and he, basically decided who should be the next leader of the Alakozai tribe, and put a turban on Kari Mulla Nakibi, the son of Mulla Nakib, and said, "Great, bam, you're the new tribal leader," and flew off again in his helicopter. So the center actually did have a lot of say in what happened in the periphery. Partly because of the centralized system of government in Afghanistan. The local governors are not elected. They're appointed by the president. And then, the governor has a lot of say, a lot of influence on what happens in his province. So, it is highly centralized, and it's that's been a hard thing to deal with sometimes. There is an argument out there for more local elections. It's highly contentious, but it's interesting to remember the, and I think I say in the book, sort of the charming weakness of the Zahir Shah times. I wasn't there, obviously. I'm too young to remember the 1970s when King Zahir Shah was ruling Afghanistan. But the stories that people tell in Kandahar make you think that that relation between the center and the periphery was actually fairly weak, fairly tenuous. That, you know, King Zahir Shah maybe didn't quite rule Afghanistan in quite the way you imagine, you know, a king ruling over all of his subjects. The story that I always tell from Kandahar is that, you know, one day in the 1970s, one of the police chiefs had some business out in the districts, perhaps Shawalikot, you know, north of Kandahar City. And these days, if the police chief wants to go to Shawalikot, he brings 100 or 200 armed men. You know, it is a major operation to push out there and do something and come back. And at the time, he just, you know, sent word that to the local elders that he wanted to go out there. And he was just packing a pistol, you know, that was his only protection, went out there by himself. And the local elders protected him. And he, you know, did his business, had the conversations he needed to have, whatever. And then he went back to back to Kandahar City safely. And the next day, there was a giant delegation of tribal elders waiting for him at police headquarters the next morning. And he was initially worried. He thought, "Oh, geez, you know, like have I caused offense? Like, what's the problem here?" And the leader of the delegation simply said, "Sir, you forgot your hat." And you know, they were coming to bring him back his officer's cap. And the story is told in Kandahar to illustrate this kind of respectful relationship between the center and the periphery, where you know, neither really ruled the other, to be honest with you. You know, in some ways, you know, we're starting to see some of that emerge again as the troops withdraw, and you're starting to see some of the wiser local leaders in Afghanistan, you know, start to really focus on mending relations with the periphery. So that's, I mean, if that can happen more, you know, more widespread way, then we might, you know, this might the situation might be okay.
So I mean, you know, I'm sort of interested in the idea of corruption. Then, I mean, how? I mean, I guess in the United States, we do hear a lot of stories about, you know, mansions being built, you know, government officials and governors building mansions, and sort of, you know, the same four or five guys run for president. You know, I think it's Rashid Dostum. Gosh, I can't remember the guy, the balding fellow who's a doctor, Gilani. And it almost seems like, you know, there's a lot of corruption. I mean, at least, you know, from the perspective of, you know, just reading the papers. So, I mean, you know, is corruption a problem? And then, you know, is it, how deep is it and how widespread is it?
Look, I'll be honest with you, like, and very blunt. You know, I'm speaking to you from Kabul, Afghanistan, where I run a very small NGO operation. I need to, you know, be able to stay in the country and do my work. I'm not going to tell you everything I know about corruption in this country. That's just how the game is played. You know, it is a problem. I think, in some ways, the corruption could be a blessing during this transition period. At least that's the take of the World Bank. I'm paraphrasing them, of course, but you know, the World Bank's estimate is that the giant rush of money out of Afghanistan over the next few years, as troops withdraw and aid budgets are clawed back, that may not have as much of a devastatingly disruptive effect as you might imagine, with billions of dollars leaving the country, because so much of the aid was siphoned off in any case. So, you know, if you're one of the property dealers in Dubai who was making money hand over fist, selling, you know, beachfront homes to you know, corrupt figures in the Afghan government, maybe you have reason to worry. But you know, the theory of the World Bank is that that perhaps it won't, the Afghanistan's economy won't be so fundamentally disrupted, because we are at the end of the day talking about a largely agricultural economy. That being said, the corruption has deeply jaundiced the relationship between the donors and Afghanistan. These days, when I travel around Western capitals and I talk to people who are involved with Afghanistan, especially the Western officials who have some experience with the country, who have been following this file for years and years, a lot of them are tired. You know, a lot of them are a bit fed up. And so just at an emotional level, I think the corruption takes a toll on donors. My job now for the International Crisis Group is to sort of look at the situation from a point of view of peace and stability. And so in that sort of purely pragmatic way, I think what I'm worried about is whether salaries are making it down to the lowest level of the police ranks, to the lowest level of the ALP ranks. Are ordinary Afghan soldiers getting paid on time? Because that's where the rubber hits the road, essentially. And so I was very concerned. I came back from Kandahar this summer, and I was very concerned to speak with some people in the ALP who said that the bank accounts where their salaries are supposed to show up were sometimes empty. The salaries just didn't show up. They weren't transferred from Kabul to Kandahar. At least that's what they say. I mean, it's possible that the commander is just skimming the money and pocketing it and not giving it to his men. I don't know. But the point is that, there were complaints that this was a problem. I've been bouncing that around in some other places. I did not hear the same complaints in Kunar. I did not hear the same complaints in Faryab. But, again, this is a core problem. If the corruption is so bad that, the bullets and the diesel and the salaries and the basic supplies that you need to fight a war are not reaching the front lines, then, that's an existential threat to the Afghan government.
I'm sort of curious. I mean, you framed corruption as a problem of aid money and sort of money coming from the international community, but how much do you factor in sort of illicit sort of the money sort of coming from the opium trade? I mean, is it sort of, two flows of corruption, so to speak, from the top down and then also from sort of the bottom up? Or is it really?
Well, obviously drug corruption is a problem. But it's funny enough, I've seen places where drug corruption really helps the Afghan government survive, because I've been to remote parts of Afghanistan where the police aren't really being paid on time, so they're not getting enough help from Kabul, but the money they can make protecting the opium trade keeps them alive, keeps them, they can still go to the market and buy bullets. Obviously drug corruption is a bad thing and it undermines the structure of the Afghan government. But in some places it's, some places it's good from the point of view of, helping the Afghan state survive. If it weren't for drug corruption, there would be very little reason to want to be a police commander in some of these remote outposts. It just wouldn't make sense. So I don't know. I mean, it's obviously it's a vicious thing, but none of these problems are simple in Afghanistan. They are all very, very intertwined with each other, and it's often not as clear cut as it looks.
So I want to sort of transition. We've talked about sort of really gritty issues and sort of from the bottom up, so to speak, and I want to sort of look at it from this conflict from 30,000 feet. And, I want to start with the idea that you, I think,
I would say that's a problem, by the way, that so often has been looked at from 30,000 feet, but anyways, go on.
Oh, no. Okay. I mean, you, in our sort of pre-interview conversation, you made the point of a continuous series of surges, which I found interesting because, it almost implies that, NATO, the United States, Canada, NATO could never really hold enough territory in the South to impose order. And so it almost seems like your phrase almost implies that you had to keep on sending troops and cycling in more troops and more troops, but NATO was never able to hit that sort of ideal amount of troops to sort of, you know, impose order or create order, or, you know, whatever verb you want to use. So, I mean, you know, do you think that framing a strategy around surging as opposed to long-term occupation, you know, I'm even laughing when I say that because it almost seems like surging is more feasible than occupation for a long period of time. But, you know, walk us through, I mean, sort of explain what you meant by sort of continuous series of surges.
Well, what I mean is that growth of the pro-government forces from about 2,500 to about 70,000, you know, between roughly 2005 to 2011. I mean, it was that growth, a fair bit of it happened during the so-called Obama surge, right, towards the end. But if you look at the line graph, it's actually it's a fairly steady climb. And I don't know. I mean, there are lots of, you can play lots of imagination games about, you know, how this could have been done more effectively. There are still people who are, you know, much smarter than me here in Kabul, who have a lot more experience than I do, who say that it might have been possible to rush in a bunch of troops perhaps a little more quickly than 2005, you know, perhaps when there was a bit more of a window of opportunity in, say, 2003. And they, you know, their narrative is, you know, if we hadn't been distracted by Iraq, for example, if we had put in a much larger contingent that had been able to take control in a more civilized way, and you know, you could actually do that sort of clear, hold, and build thing. And in fact, you know, my own organization, the International Crisis Group, co-signed a declaration with more than 80, you know, NGOs and think tanks and other sort of leading voices, calling for precisely that. And there are still people who are bitter that that sort of big military option wasn't exercised quickly enough or effectively enough. For me, you know, having been on the front lines of that, having watched the surge firsthand, the surges firsthand, I was never convinced that that the whole premise of the thing was going to work out. You know, the some of the basic tenets of counterinsurgency theory, I think, need to be looked at closely and see, you know, to see if they correspond with reality. My favorite example of this is the prison on the west side of Kandahar City. There have been three jailbreaks at Sarposa Prison in Kandahar, and in all of them, there were, you know, warning signs that were missed. Local people who knew things who just didn't say anything to us. This was a place that was firmly under the control of the foreign troops. We cleared it, you know, we held it. We built it up. We physically built it up. The place was crawling with foreign trainers and advisors, and you know, it went from being a kind of crumbling medieval ruin where chunks of masonry fell on the inmates as they were sleeping, and you know, snakes and rats slithered out of the scurried out of the little chinks in the wall at night, and you know, would bite the inmates. It went from being this medieval hellhole to being, you know, a sort of somewhat modernized, better defended, you know, place with, you know, staff that were better trained. And yet, you know, none of that mattered in the end. It was, you know, on three occasions, the Taliban literally walked out of there because the hearts and minds were not won, essentially. The people who live around there, the staff who worked there, you were not sufficiently convinced about the foreigners in general. If coin doesn't work in a place like that, that is so completely under our control, it's really hard to it's hard to see how it could have been applied properly in Afghanistan. I mean, some of my friends who still believe in coin theory say that, look, it was never actually applied properly in Afghanistan. The core tenets of coin were not followed through on, and that's possible, to be fair. I think a lot of this fight was inherently political, and we treated it, as a military fight.
So, I mean, it comes sort of to the end of the interview. And, for my last question, I mean, when I read through your book, I took it as very much a sort of critique of coin, whether you had been sort of intended to make that critique or not. I took it, as sort of, a critique of this strategy that, basically argues that, you can apply force to what are inherently political and economic problems. When you started to write the book, was that your intention, or did that sort of
No.
just evolve through the narrative?
Yeah, I mean, it was my intention. And in fact, there are a lot of people out there who have the knives out for coin at the moment. It's become kind of fashionable to tear down coin. If you are looking for ammunition to tear down coin, there's bucket loads in my book, obviously. I don't know. I've only been in two wars, Libya and Afghanistan. So I don't really. I'm not an expert in general on counterinsurgency, and I've no idea whether the theory itself is good or not good. The book, to be honest with you, as I say in the introduction, does not have a lot of overarching analytical structure to it. I've just now started a job as an analyst, and now with a crisis group, I'm starting to apply some kind of formal structure and come up with recommendations. But the book itself has no thesis, really, except what I say in the introduction. We would have already mentioned about how we essentially failed. We failed to bring peace and stability, and then in the conclusion. What I add to that is to say, look, your troop surges did not work. You completely failed to bring peace and stability. But why should that discourage you? I mean, Afghanistan remains a place desperately in need of help. And it would be tragic if the international community just had a temper tantrum and took its marbles and went home. That would be, cataclysmic, I think. If there was just this abrupt, abandonment of Afghanistan. And that's what a lot of Afghans are afraid of, that that just as the huge surges of troops were fundamentally disruptive, that a huge withdrawal will leave a sort of a chaotic vacuum. And we owe it to the Afghan people. In some ways, it's interesting now. We've reached this point of decision where we have to decide what we will leave behind. How many troops, how much funding are we going to leave behind for the Afghan government? And it's going to be very interesting to watch this debate that's happening right now, because in some ways, the future of Afghanistan depends on how guilty we feel about the mess that we're leaving behind.
Oh, wow. So I think we've covered a lot today, and I want to, we always let the guest have the last word and sort of the last comment. So, give us a last word to leave us with. Maybe, a last comment, a last, idea.
Okay, my last comment is that the book is not as totally depressing as I make it sound. If you look very carefully, there is a reference somewhere in the book to naked elves.
I must have missed that. I mean, the book is actually, it's very wonderful. It's, you know, does sort of break one's heart, but it's definitely, it's good. It was brutal, intense, insightful is the phrase I used on Twitter. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Graham.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.